From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world, I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM, open lines this hour. Next hour, the controversial Michael Rupert, former LAPD cop. Are we getting ripped off by the oil companies? What about the drug cartels and other very bizarre occurrences? He hits on all of them. And by the way, next week, April 22nd, that night, will be the roundtable discussion as we talk about secret societies and some other issues. Alex Jones, Steve Quayle, Jim Mars, and Linda Moulton Howe will be my guests for the full 4 hours. Linda, by the way, to take advantage of a Christmas present that I gave her some time ago, will be here Thursday and Friday night doing both days with me. So we will have a nice program with Linda Moulton Howe. About April 22nd will be that special roundtable discussion. I know lots of you have wanted to know the exact date so you can circle it on your calendar. Alex Jones, Steve Quayle, Jim Mars, and Linda Moulton Howe will join me as we talk about some issues that affect all of us. Here's some stories that are breaking. The notorious San Andreas Fault may be on the cusp of producing a flurry of earthquakes that could rattle Southern California with a very strong trembler every few decades or less, according to a geologist. A very detailed analysis of two periods of past quake activity on a section of the fault suggests that a drawn-out period of little seismic activity may be coming to an end. That's according to University of Oregon geologist Ray Weldon. Weldon cautions that the switch could be decades away, that the flurry is a relative term since a cluster of quakes can strike over periods lasting 200 to 300 years. Our intervals, as brief as 10 years, have separated individual quakes in past clusters. One of the things that he does go on to say is that an earthquake on the southern San Andreas of a magnitude 7.5 or larger could kill thousands of people in the greater Los Angeles area and cause estimated damage in the tens of billions of dollars. On the average, he says, quakes of that size have struck roughly at 100-year intervals, although the lulls between the temblors lasted as little as 10 years and as long as 224 years. The southern portion of the fault last ruptured in 1857. Current levels of strain measured on the San Andreas are at their highest in 1,500 years, and suggests that the fault is due to begin releasing that pent-up energy as a large earthquake or quakes. As a matter of fact, I got an email just a few hours ago. Someone says, George, we just had an earthquake, 7:28 p.m. Pacific time, 5 miles from my house. I was the fourth person to report it. It felt like a big snap. Well, in that area around past Pasadena a little bit, 3.4 on the Richter scale. Very strange weather. I have continued to say what is up is down and what is down is up. And with the weather, that's exactly what's happening right now. Unusually turbulent weather in the south and the eastern parts of the United States being blamed for at least 8 deaths. I mean, can you imagine this? You wake up in the morning, expect to just go on and have your day, and all of a sudden you just never come home because of the weather. 6 in Kentucky have died, blamed on the weather-related traffic problems. 2 in Pennsylvania as a result of flooding. 1 to 3 inches of snow, is this April? 1 to 3 inches of snow fell west of Louisville, Kentucky, while several counties along the Ohio River were hit with sleet. More than 4 inches of snow fell in parts of western Tennessee. Memphis and Nashville also reported a few flurries and some sleet as well. Meteorologists dumbfounded. They said this took them by surprise. In California, 6-year-old girl was found in a ravine. She survived for 10 days on dry noodles and Gatorade while remaining near her dead mother following a crash. She was there for 10 days. Her name, the little one, Ruby Busamonte. She was in good condition at a hospital where she's recovering from obvious dehydration. She's a strong little girl, they said, very strong indeed, her uncle fighting back tears. State Transportation Department workers repairing a road barrier found the girl, her mother's body, in a wrecked Ford Taurus. 150 feet down a ravine off of the I-60 freeway, some 70 miles east of Los Angeles. They say that she told them, a little six-year-old, told them that she survived on noodles and Gatorade. The Riverside County's coroner's office says that an autopsy indicated that the mother likely died within minutes of the accident from blunt force trauma. A sad story. Well, before the 9/11/2001 terrorist attacks, legal, cultural, and operational walls hindered the FBI from making more progress on terrorism investigations and coordinating better with other intelligence agencies, according to the FBI Director Robert Mueller. We're in the FBI are committed to doing everything in our power to make sure America, again, never suffers such a loss, he told the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks upon the United States. CIA Director George Tenet also was there. He said that he's led the agency since 1997, earlier testified that the CIA provided clear and direct intelligence information to senior U.S. policymakers about the threat of al-Qaeda posing and that the role of Afghanistan playing in coddling the terror network. He said the warning was well understood. However, we never penetrated the 9/11 plot overseas. We did not discern the specific nature of the plot. 9/11 will be one of the topics we talk about next hour with Michael Rupert, by the way. An Italian kidnapped in Iraq has been executed. Earlier in the day, Arabic language satellite television station Al Jazeera announced that it had received a videotape. Even Al Jazeera said it would not show the tape. It was so graphic, showing one of four Italians being held in Iraq, the one being killed. President Bush has praised Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's plans to withdraw Israeli forces and settlements from the Gaza Strip and from parts of the West Bank. Palestinian officials say, no, we don't like this. The leadership of the Palestinians warns of the dangers of reaching any kind of accord like that. They are just not happy with this situation. They have told some news outlets that the plan to pull out of Gaza and parts of the West Bank was intended to provide cover for Israel's plan to bolster other settlements in the West Bank, where the overwhelming majority of Israeli settlers live. The Palestinian labor minister says that reinforcing and expanding these settlements would engender more terrorism. Sedna, you remember we talked about that a few weeks ago, that planetoid, not a planet, but a planetoid. The solar system's farthest known object does not have a moon. It has puzzled astronomers now. You know, originally they thought there's got to be a moon there because of its slow rotation. The slow spin was thought to be due to the gravity of a small companion body. Researchers have now discounted this, but say that the unexpected finding may still offer clues to the origin and evolution of objects in the solar system's edge. Sedna was discovered on March 15th. A lot of excitement about this. The co-discoverer, Mike Brown of the California Institute of Technology, was so convinced at first that Sedna had a satellite that the artist concept of the object commissioned to accompany the announcement included a hypothetical moon. He says that his belief was based on the fact that Sedna appears to have a very slow rotation, which could be best explained by the gravitational pull of a companion body. He says, I'm completely baffled at the absence of a moon. This is outside the realm of expectation and makes Sedna even more interesting, but I simply don't know what it means. I wonder what it does mean. By the way, coming out of Illinois, the meteorites that punched through roofs in Park Forest, Illinois, about a year ago, March 26, 2003, came from a larger mass that weighed no less than about a ton before it hit the atmosphere. This is according to scientific analysis led by the University of Chicago's Stephen Simon, who, by the way, happened to live very close to that area where the meteorites fell. It was a great story. The meteorite also showed signs that it had been highly shocked, possibly when it was part of a rock that was broken from a much larger asteroid following a collision. The evidence for the shock includes really some mineral that they found on some of the meteorites. Lemons. How many times do you chop up a lemon for whatever you use those things, and you got to fight getting those seeds out of them, huh? Drives you nuts, doesn't it? Well, maybe not anymore. Seedless lemons are to go on sale first in the United Kingdom this week. And what producers claim, this is going to be the beginning. The variety is called Seedless Eureka, discovered by chance by a grower in South Africa. Suppliers say that the farmer found a tree full of lemons without the seeds, and he was able to export a limited quantity after spending 7 years nurturing the crop. He said that this will be a revolution for people who like to use lemons. Here's my question, though. So if you have a fruit that has no seeds, how does it reproduce itself? I'm baffled by that. By the way, I've got another email in about dying raccoons north of San Diego. If anybody lives in that region, check in with me. George, just north of San Diego, raccoons have been dying for some unknown reason. And people in the beach area, mostly children, have been getting sick. Authorities know about this. They're keeping it quiet. And this email came from somebody in Dallas, Texas, of all places. But if you live in that San Diego area and you can get through on the lines tonight, tell me if you've heard anything about that story. Here are the phone numbers. West of the Rockies, 800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 800-825-5033. First-time caller line, 818-501-4721. And that wild card line, because you just have no idea what's going to happen, 818-501-4109. By the way, Arab television stations have aired a new audio tape purportedly from Osama bin Laden. Late tonight, he is offering a truce with European states if they stop attacking Muslims, but we're not with the United States. So we'll continue to track this story. The tape message also vowed revenge on Israel for the death of Hamas leader Ahmad Yassin, killed last month in Gaza. It was not immediately possible to verify the authenticity of the tape, though the voice sounded like previous tapes thought to be genuine. The CIA has said that some previous tapes, purportedly from bin Laden, were likely to be genuine. Bin Laden's al-Qaeda network is blamed by Washington for the 9/11 attacks on U.S. cities. So he's asking Europe for a truce, but not the United States. Michael Rupert is the publisher-editor of From the Wilderness, or FTW, a newsletter he founded in March 1998. Through the newsletter and his website, www.fromthewilderness.com, which is linked up right now, and coasttocoastam.com. Mike has pioneered innovative analysis and groundbreaking stories on the multi-billion dollar U.S. drug economy and the illegal covert operations, which maintain control of that cash flow for U.S. economic interests. Since 9/11, he has been the point man in breaking major stories involving government foreknowledge, corruption, violations of the Constitution. He has also pioneered the effort to educate the world about the consequences of peak oil. An honors graduate of UCLA in political science, Mike is a former LAPD narcotics investigator who discovered CIA trafficking in drugs in 1977. After attempting to expose this, he was forced out of the police department in 1978 while earning the highest rating reports possible and having no pending disciplinary actions. He is our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Michael, how are you?
I'm fine, George. It's good to be with you.
Good to talk with you, too. Let's chat a little bit about all these things that are going on, but give all of us an understanding of who Michael Rupert is.
Well, if you were to ask me privately, which, of course, we're not now, but I would probably say I was a guy who had really bad luck. I was born into a family with very deep intelligence connections. My mother had been a cryptanalyst for the Army Security Agency, which was a forerunner of the NSA during World War II. Her work product was viewed by Secretary of State Cordell Hull throughout World War II. She had, of course, the highest clearances possible. She had worked on Japanese codes and Russian to attract Russian nuclear scientists up until she left in about 1949, 1950. My father had been an Air Force officer who went to work for Martin Marietta on projects related to CIA programs, notably the Titan IIIC, which puts up the keyhole spy satellites. Relatives of my dad's were career at CIA headquarters in Langley. Everybody in the family had a clearance. I was born in Washington, D.C., into that environment. Moved quite heavily until I was a junior in high school, where we came to Los Angeles. When I graduated from Venice High School in 69, I started interning for LAPD. I knew that I wanted to be a policeman, even before I had gone to college. And LAPD ran a background check and found out that I had a Q clearance just because I lived in the same house with my mother
right,
and father.
Right, right.
And so quickly I was interning for the chief of police. And I was getting some very choice assignments. I was an honor student, and I was chosen to intern for the chief. And the CIA tried to recruit me once officially when I was a senior. I did not accept the invitation. I did not go to work for CIA. Joined LAPD in 1973, was valedictorian of my academy class, hit the streets in South Central, was promoting rapidly, and a second recruitment effort occurred through a very beautiful woman who became my fiance. That was a little different than the first one.
Right.
And it was through that that I was exposed to the fact that CIA was actively involved in bringing drugs into the U.S., saw those arrangements being made with my own eyes, refused to get involved in that, terminated the relationship, and tried to blow the whistle, but I don't think anybody really wanted to listen to me then. I didn't realize how deeply CIA was wired in through major police departments throughout the country, including my own. And as a result of that, I'd been shot at, was threatened, burglarized, harassed, and I got a death threat in November of 1978, which I tape recorded. I asked to see our chief of police then, Daryl Gates, and received a message back. Well, he's real busy. He can give you 5 or 10 minutes in a week to 10 days. If you're still alive, would you like to make an appointment? That's when I resigned. Those experiences have determined the course of my life really from that day to this.
Would you have been forced out of the police department, Michael, had you not resigned?
I think I would have been shot had I not resigned. I had been placed in a position where as a police officer I had fewer rights than I did as a citizen. I had a very wonderful attorney. We had a great paper trail. And by resigning and getting on record with the FBI locally, with some politicians locally, we kind of created an insurance policy for me. Had I chosen to shut up, I might have retired a couple years ago as a deputy chief. But I just couldn't do that.
Why not? Why couldn't you just say, you know what, I can't fight this, and I'm just going to do the best I can for myself?
Well, I'm one of those crazy fools that kind of has to believe in what he's doing, that kind of has to believe in the rightness of what he's doing. And what I had seen told me that something was fundamentally broken deep in the bowels of the U.S. government and the way the U.S. worked as a country. As a nation, it was a serious problem that could not have occurred without the highest level of approval. I didn't understand all of how, you know, the hundreds of billions of dollars in drug cash was moved into Wall Street and through U.S. banks or any of that at the time. But I just knew that what I had seen was wrong, and that if I really wanted to go after bad guys, I was going after the wrong ones.
I must have been in St. Louis when I remember a story breaking in the Los Angeles Times about the CIA and drug trafficking and things they wanted to do with people and kids and gangs in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
Were you behind that story?
No, I had really gone on record back in 1978, I think was. 79 was my first contact with the LA Times. I was used extensively on a number of stories as a source, a background source. But I wasn't directly connected with stories that broke in the LA Times. Now, in 1996, however, Gary Webb, a Pulitzer Prize winner from the San Jose Mercury News, broke a great series of stories directly tying with documents the CIA to the crack cocaine epidemic. I did get very much involved in the controversy that erupted after that, and had a face-to-face confrontation with then-CIA Director John Deutsch on ABC Nightline television all over the world, and basically left him a stumbling, bumbling, babbling, hand-wringing guy up on the podium, not knowing how to respond when I confronted him with names of specific CIA operations and said I had documents showing that they were real.
One of the, I believe, strengths of this program, Michael, and you know me from our chats in the Midwest,
mm-hmm.
is, you know, I'm not going to stick my head in the sand. And if there's a great story, if there's a important guest, I'm going to get them on this program, and I'm going to let the nation hear this person, make up their own minds. And you are one of those, one of the most controversial people I think we've had on Coast to Coast. I want you to address one thing of a couple people who have emailed me today, and they merely say, Michael Rupert is anti-American. And I want to give you that opportunity to address that first, clear the air about that, about some of the things that we may or may not talk about tonight. But I want you at least to be able to explain yourself to some of those who believe that because of the things you've done, the allegations you've made, they claim that you're anti-American.
Well, if it is anti-American to believe that the Constitution is a document which should be inviolate, then I guess I'm anti-American. We've lost parts of the First, Fourth, Fifth, Sixth, and Eighth Amendments of the U.S. Constitution since 9/11. If it's un-American to believe that committing crimes is wrong, then I'm un-American. If it's un-American to believe in a sense of fair play for whoever is involved of whatever race, creed, color, religion, nationality, then I'm un-American. I don't even think in terms of that, because the America that I was taught to believe in was a nation of fair play. It was a nation of rules and principles that could not be compromised. That was the great safety that was provided for all Americans in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights that made us different, supposedly, and set us apart. I am an American. I'm fighting for the health, the safety, the mental health of my country at a time when it seems to be really challenged.
Next week, I'm going to have several guests on as we talk about secret societies. I want to ask you this, Michael. Do you believe that among the things we're going to talk about tonight, which includes what's going on with the drugs, oil, 9/11, mm-hmm. do you believe, as some do, that a lot of this is influenced by this very secret shadow group, call it the Illuminati, call it whatever you want, but that these people, whomever they may be, maybe heads of corporations, those who benefit from things like this, but they're the ones really calling the shots here. Do you think that's true?
Well, you will never hear me as a journalist, as an investigator. I mean, my publication is read by 35 members of Congress and at 30 universities around the world. You will never hear me use or publish the term Illuminati. The reason for that is that I have never seen any documentation that is verifiable evidence that this organization exists. You will hear me talk about the Council on Foreign Relations. You will hear me talk about the Trilateral Commission. You will hear me talk about the Bilderbergers,
mm-hmm.
Because we can prove that those organizations exist. But I often am asked this question in lectures. I've lectured in 8 countries, some 39 times since 9/11. And this is one of the most frequently asked questions that I get. And what I say is, if I ever meet a guy who is at the same time a Mason, a member of Opus Dei of the Catholic Church, a member of Skull and Bones, a member of Knights of Malta, a member of the Mafia, a member of Propaganda Due, or any of these other groups, who is a member of all of them, I'll shoot him on the spot because I know I found Mr. Big. I don't see one single secret society as being the root cause of everything. What I see is the way money works. Is as being the governing factor in the current paradigm.
Money has become the greed factor for all of this, hasn't it?
Yes. Always my basic question is, show me how the money works. That's what I want to know.
And it's as if they have a thirst for more and more and more. I mean, what can you do when you're worth $1 billion? Why do you need $2 billion?
Well, because somebody else may have 2.3 and you have envy, I guess. You know.
Well, I look forward to this chat with you tonight. You know, originally I wanted to start off by talking about what's going on with the oil situation and some of those companies behind this, but because of Bin Laden's late-minute apparent statement tonight that he wants a treaty and a truce with Europe, but not the United States, let's talk a little bit about what's happening and get your take on 9/11 and everything else. But let's go back a little bit further, if we can,
mm-hmm.
because to a lot of Americans, the name Osama bin Laden really didn't come up until 9/11. I mean, many people in this country just didn't know who this person was until that horrible day.
Right.
However, He'd been known to this country for years. So let's talk a little bit about that relationship. What do you know about this country's relationship with Osama bin Laden years gone back?
Well, we first started reporting on bin Laden in 1998. If you go to the website, we have a great search engine, and type his name in, you'll find our stories back from 1998, which at the time had tied him, of course, he was a hot topic after the embassy bombings in East Africa. But we reported at the time that there were direct links between Osama bin Laden and his al-Qaeda network and security support for the Kosovo Liberation Army, which at the time was an ally of the United States.
Correct.
Wesley Clark, as commander of NATO, was supporting the KLA. And that was at a point in time when Osama bin Laden's brother-in-law was one of the chief security advisors for the KLA, and members of al-Qaeda were, in fact, fighting with the KLA. This at a time when the KLA was controlling some 70% of the heroin, according to the Christian Science Monitor, that was entering Western Europe. Bin Laden as an individual, his first show on the radar screen goes back to the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan in 1979. He turned up in Afghanistan to fight with the Mujahideen in about 1983, I believe it was. He was taken under the protective custody of Prince Turki, who was the chief of Saudi intelligence, some Pakistani officials, and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who was one of the CIA's chief warlords, where his family, his construction business, was used to construct a great many bunkers, caves, storage facilities, etc., in Afghanistan. So the CIA was working with bin Laden as far back as the mid-1980s. There's an excellent record of this that's been well established.
Did we funnel billions of dollars and or arms to him to try to get the Soviets out of Afghanistan?
Well, I would not say it's correct to say that we gave them directly to bin Laden. No. His role at the time was as a construction guy and a financier. His family is enormously wealthy.
Yes.
Very few people in America know that the bin Laden group of companies in Saudi Arabia owns and operates, I think it's something like 14 satellites relaying cell phone calls. They operate car dealerships, soft drink franchises. They are a major multinational conglomerate, one of the largest companies in Saudi Arabia. So Osama, who has, I think, something like 23 brothers and sisters, comes from this family. So he showed up in Afghanistan. He didn't receive, I don't think, the Stingers and the other weapons directly. The Mujahideen did. I don't think he was working as a combatant at the time.
Was he liked by the United States during that period?
I don't think, when you talk in terms of covert operations, and I've known a great many CIA people, I still talk to CIA people, they don't think in terms of like. All they think in terms of is useful. He was definitely useful.
My enemy of my enemy, right?
Exactly.
So, you know, he contributes to getting the Soviets out after spending at least 10 years fighting the Afghans. The Soviets decided, hey, we're getting out of this game. Mm-hmm. And they decide to hightail it back to whatever was left of their country before that broke up. What happens to bin Laden then? I mean, you know, the Soviets are out. What does he do?
Well, he kind of dropped off the radar screen for a while. He started surfacing, from what I can glean, in the early 1990s, after the U.S. was invited onto Saudi soil as a result of Desert Storm 1, for fanatical Muslims, the presence of quote-unquote Gentiles or infidels on holy soil is an insult. And as the U.S. opened military bases in Saudi Arabia, that became a source of anger for a great many Muslim activists. Bin Laden's name starts to turn up then. It's a very strange coincidence, ironically, that the first country, however, to put out a warrant on him was Libya.
Yeah, Gaddafi's Libya.
Yeah, because bin Laden was supposedly going to kill Gaddafi. He started to gain prominence throughout the 90s. Now, ostensibly, his family says that they severed ties with him, I think, in about 1996, which is really a bunch of bunk. I have a book coming out this summer called Truth and Lies of 9/11, America's Descent into Fascism at the End of the Age of Oil. And in that book, I completely deconstruct the myth that he was disowned by his family. He traveled throughout the Middle East, spent a lot of time in Sudan, where there are reports that the Sudanese government had actually offered to capture him and turn him over to Uncle Sam, I think in 1998 or 99, and the U.S. government refused. And so he went back to Afghanistan and took up with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda.
You mean we didn't want him?
Well, no, he was supposedly wanted at the time, but I have some incredible intelligence documentation showing that we were monitoring his cell phone calls. We knew where he was. We knew when he was traveling. I'm amazed at the contradiction between a point in time when the wild man Ali North was going to dispatch fighters to catch Abu Nidal after the Achille Moro incident, but no one would even take a chartered jet knowing that Osama bin Laden was on it when he was supposedly the most wanted guy in the world.
All right, stay with us, Michael. And, of course, Abu Nidal ended up being shot in Iraq sometime last year, I believe, or maybe even the year before. And I'll be back in just a moment. Michael Rupert. Michael, we'll continue talking about this because setting up the stage with exactly getting your take on who Osama bin Laden is, I think, is very important to the rest of tonight. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back for the special edition of Coast to Coast with Michael Rupert as we talk about these things going on all around this planet. Michael, okay, let's pick it up. So Osama bin Laden is doing his thing. The Soviet Union decides to leave Afghanistan, yet we've got an ability to arrest him, to pick him up. And I believe it was then during the Clinton administration we decided we didn't want anything to do with him, huh?
No, we let him go back to Afghanistan. And there is a very credible body of evidence that's well documented that I'll be citing in my book, but it's been brought out elsewhere, showing that there was an ulterior motive here because Afghanistan was a totally fragmented country at the time. And at the same time, there were major oil companies, including Unocal, among others. Halliburton was deeply involved, desperately seeking to construct pipelines across Afghanistan from what was hoped for or hoped would be a major bonanza from Caspian Sea wells in Kazakhstan, in the Tengiz and Kashagan fields, as well as huge natural gas deposits in Turkmenistan, and they couldn't build the pipelines unless the country was pacified. There was a good book documenting this that told at least part of the truth of 9/11, called The Forbidden Truth. That was extremely well-sourced using documents. And, in fact, members of the Taliban were brought to Texas for a barbecue by Unocal in 1998.
You've got to be kidding me.
No.
Members of the Taliban taken to Texas for a barbecue in 1998.
That's correct. And the hopes were that a deal could be reached wherein the Taliban would allow or pacify the country and then allow pipelines to be built. This led to a series of frenetic negotiations before 9/11, starting in 2000, by a group known as the 6+2, composed of six countries with witnesses, including Pakistan and Afghanistan, trying to make a deal with the Taliban, which eventually led to an ultimatum saying, we will either bury you under a carpet of gold or we will bury you under a carpet of bombs.
All right, so the Taliban at that time then, with their very strict measures, you know, the repression of women, and they did, and things like that, but they, what they steadfast and they said, we're not going to let you in here?
Well, they just, the book by two authors named Brice South and Dasguier was a little bit vague as to what soured everything. My personal take on reading it is that the oil companies in the U.S. just wouldn't agree to all the terms that the Taliban wanted in terms of oil revenues, profit sharing, oil for the Afghani people, etc.
They weren't happy with the partnership split.
Correct. And but those negotiations, it's very interesting to note, continued seamlessly from the Clinton administration into the early days of the Bush administration with people who had left the Clinton State Department, one in particular who I write about extensively, named Carl Inderforth, or Rick Inderforth is his nickname, continuing in a second level as a private citizen, but still on behalf of the U.S. government with the negotiations almost right until the time the first plane hit the World Trade Center.
Now, Afghanistan, really no resources, didn't have oil, didn't have the gas, but it did have the land that the pipeline needed to go across.
And they also had opium.
Lots and lots of opium.
Now, one thing that is incredibly significant here that the world has been horribly misled on, is extremely well documented, is that in January of 2001, after instituting a ban the previous summer, the Taliban destroyed 94% of all the opium poppies in Afghanistan, which and it was at that time the single largest producer of opium, which is the source of heroin, on the planet.
Indeed.
And I was attending in March of 2001 an economic conference in Moscow, Russia, and I had learned of this destruction, and I said, oh my God, they've just taken, it could be as much as $200 billion in liquid cash when you factor in all the levels of sales up to the street level sales, you know, out of the world's banking system. And that's the American banking system. That was an act of economic warfare against the United States government. It was also the single most effective drug eradication program in human history. And I said, you better watch it. I even wrote at the time, and it's on the website, that everybody better watch out. There's going to be serious trouble with Afghanistan. And that was in March and April of 2001 that I was writing this. Now, it's not coincidental, in fact, that we occupied Afghanistan in November of 2001. And November is the planting season. You plant the opium poppies in November, and you harvest in late May, early June. And a bumper crop was planted as soon as the U.S. got into the country.
You mean the growing of the opium is now back in full force?
As a matter of fact, to quote a recent story from CNN, opium production is now 34 times higher than it was under the Taliban, 3,400% higher. Afghanistan is now producing, I think, between 70 and 75% of the world's heroin.
Who's controlling this?
CIA is.
Why are you still alive?
Well, one of my favorite sayings is, I won't die a minute before God says so, which kind of relieves me of having to worry about that. But I think that at this late juncture in my life, with a newsletter that's read in 35 countries and by 35 members of Congress, the intelligence committees of both houses, that I have a measure of safety that if I drop dead tomorrow, people might ask some questions.
And after this program, we've either saved your life or we've contributed to your demise. I'm not sure.
Well, nobody's going to blame you for it. I would be doing what I do anyway.
All right. Thanks for that sign of confidence there with that. Well, so the opium production is up dramatically, and you say the CIA is behind that. How do you know that?
Well, that's probably those are the waters that I have swum in more deeply than anything else for more than 20 years now. I have studied, interviewed people, met DEA agents. I have lived in the waters of CIA involvement in the drug trade. It's extremely well documented. And I don't say anything that I can't prove. In dozens of stories, I have cited even CIA documents, including an Inspector General report from 1998, which, if you read it, just contains some of the most damning admissions in the world. But going back to the Vietnam War, it's extremely well documented. It continued certainly through Iran-Contra, when U.S. cocaine consumption went from roughly 80 metric tons in 1979 to 600 metric tons by 1986. That money goes through Wall Street. We have a report from Senator Carl Levin's Minority Committee on Correspondent Banking in January of 2001 admitting that at least a half a trillion dollars a year in criminal money was laundered through U.S. banks and financial markets. Whoever controls that money has an economic edge, as anyone who understands, who's ever borrowed money for a car understands. The difference in your monthly payment when you get a car loan at 1% and 10% is like an enormous jump in your payment.
Sure.
It's called the cost of capital.
Absolutely.
And whoever has the lowest cost of capital, whether it's buying a car or competing on the world economic stage, always wins.
What would happen if all that drug money that has been filtering through brokerage firms, Wall Street, U.S. banks, what would happen if it just completely dried up and stopped?
Well, probably if it, that's a real strong hypothetical, and I don't think it's very likely.
No, nor do I.
Were it to happen, you would have an instant economic collapse. And we have been on the brink of that several times, not as a result of the drug money going away, just because it's a crisis of liquidity. Everybody knows that you got to have liquid cash to make your car payment and your credit card payments. It's no different on Wall Street if you're paying back bonds or if you're paying dividends or if you're paying off a leverage buyout or anything else. It's the liquid cash that really counts.
So some may say, though, Michael, well, I don't use drugs. My family doesn't use drugs. And the fact that this money continues to flow through the country and through the system, in the long run, I'm indirectly benefiting. I've got a pretty decent mortgage. I got a nice loan on a car. Mm-hmm. So, you know what? Okay. This is a good standard of living. How many people would say that?
It's a great question. One of my closest friends in the whole world, who has really been one of my economic mentors, Catherine Austin Fitz, is a former managing director of the Wall Street Investment Bank, Dillon Reed. She's also a former assistant secretary of housing, and she and I have collaborated on really understanding how all this works, and it's been a wonderful chemistry between us. She gave a lecture talking about the same subject in Pennsylvania, I think about 2 years ago, to some very wealthy Philadelphians. And she put a red button on the table in front of her, you know, a little piece of paper, and said, okay, this is a button, and if you could push it, you would stop the drug trade. How many people would push it? And she said out of 100 people, only one person would push the button. We are not necessarily all addicted to drugs, but the American economy is absolutely addicted to drug money.
True. How many of our members of Congress in percent and our members of the Senate, the congressmen and women, how many of them are aware of what you're saying tonight and they're doing nothing about this?
That's a great question. Because denial is not a river in Egypt. It's kind of a pathological disease. I think a great many members, and I have spoken to, I guess in my career, maybe 15 or 20 on a personal basis, some more than others. Most of them don't know, don't want to know. Some of them do know. Some of them don't want to ask the question. Some of them just turn around and walk away when you try to bring it up. And others, if they're frank, will say, yeah, but there's nothing we can do about it.
So let's back up just a bit now, because we're setting the stage for what we're going to continue to talk about tonight, Michael. So negotiations with the Taliban just don't work. The barbecue may have gone well, but they just can't cut the right deal. So at what point does someone, some buddies, a couple corporations say, we got to get them out and we're going to solve two problems? One, we're going to get the opium back. Mm-hmm. And we're going to get a pipeline built whenever mm-hmm. we need to. So this government goes. How was that plan concocted?
Well, there's a part of that plan that we really have to talk about before we go there. And because the negotiations with the Taliban was one track, but there was a two-track plan.
What was the other plan?
I have published on my website links and cited stories published throughout India. It's a very big magazine in India called India Reacts. The BBC had reported on it. Jane's Defense Weekly had also mentioned it. Throughout the summer, the spring and summer of 2001, it was known throughout the region that the U.S. had a military plan to invade Afghanistan in October. That was long before 9/11. And the Taliban was aware of this. We had been pre-positioning military personnel in Uzbekistan, in the city of Tashkent, where Air America, or a reincarnated Air America in the form of Southern Air Transport and some components of Evergreen Air, were operating. In Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, we had special forces troops training their military. We had been moving troops for a long time preparing to invade Afghanistan, and that was the second track. So when things came to a head, if you will, in the fall of 2001, it's obviously very clear that a decision was made to invade Afghanistan, but we needed a pretext to do that. So that's just one of many reasons.
Now, surely Osama bin Laden, the thug that he is, the murderer that he is, obviously knew with his camps in Afghanistan that if he had done 9/11, he'd be on the run for the rest of his life. And many of his al-Qaeda members would be caught and, you know, killed and everything else. He must have known this, right?
Well, yeah, that's assuming a fact of which I'm not completely convinced, that Osama bin Laden was the sole perpetrator of 9/11. That he had a role in it, I absolutely don't doubt. But I think he was acting more as a CIA asset in that role.
Maybe, as I've thought, a contract killer.
Yeah, but it's a funny thing about the spy business. The spies love it when they can make people do things without knowing who's pulling the strings. A great example is the wonderful movie Lawrence of Arabia, where T.E. Lawrence is out running around doing all these things with Arabs, getting them to do things. And they really don't know who's pulling the strings or what the ultimate motive is until the end of the movie.
But they're just doing it.
That's right. We have clear evidence. It's a funny little juxtaposition that I talk about in my book, where I say that many of the religious texts that were like so full of hate and violence were printed at the University of Nebraska, which was also printing the oil field manuals for Unocal.
Now that is interesting. That is interesting. Yeah.
So, you know, bin Laden was in place, and there were two very credible stories showing that in, I think it was July of 2000.
Well, let me ask you, if you were in a room with bin Laden and you had a gun, would you shoot him?
Well, I wouldn't shoot anybody. I mean, I'm a
trained... Well, you said you would shoot the one guy who was a member of all those organizations.
Yeah, but that was being very facetious because I don't think there is such a guy. But I wouldn't shoot anybody unless he was a direct threat to my life. You know, what I was trained to do as a policeman, and I was in two shootings as an L.A. police officer, is that I don't take a life unless my life or somebody else's life is immediately threatened. I would certainly arrest him because I'd rather have him talk to find out what he knows than kill him.
All right. All right. Well, you bring up an interesting subject with him, too, that he may have been part of a bigger picture. And that bigger picture, and probably, are you saying he didn't even know it?
Well, I'm saying he certainly knew part of it because, you know, this is another area we didn't quite go into. But his family, the bin Laden family and the Bush family, have had business relationships going back into the 1970s. And that also is extremely well documented. Just one very interesting vignette there is that his older brother, Salim bin Laden, had made a $50,000 investment with Texas investment banker Jim Bath, and I think it was 1978. Right after that, Arbusto Energy, which was George W. Bush's company, got a $50,000 investment.
Mm-hmm.
There were, you know, the relationships between the Bush and the bin Laden family continued up through 2001. On 9/11, the Carlyle Group was holding a meeting just blocks from the White House, and members of the bin Laden family were heavy investors in the bin Laden Group. And George Herbert Walker Bush was one of Carlyle's principal advisors.
True.
Along with Jim Baker.
True.
So, you know, the business relationships go back. There are connections that go back through Iran-Contra, through BCCI, through a great many scandals showing that this family that's very powerful in Saudi Arabia, with direct ties to Khalid bin Mahfouz, who is the Saudis' biggest banker, who was a part of BCCI, was closely connected to Bush also.
And did not one of the bin Ladens die in a plane crash in Texas, in a plane that was used for strange purposes in the old days?
That was Salim, who was killed.
The brother?
Yes. One of many brothers.
And I had heard that the plane was a reconditioned plane that might have been used by the Contras, for example.
Well, those things turn up everywhere. One of the biggest stories we ever broke at From the Wilderness that was actually picked up by the Associated Press, a reporter named Bryson Hull picked it up. We showed that while he was governor of Texas, one of George Bush's favorite airplanes was a Beechcraft King Air 200, which is a wonderful turboprop airplane, that had been owned by the drug runner Barry Seal during Iran-Contra. And yet it was owned by the state of Texas, and George W. loved to fly on it. So those things happen frequently.
Let's talk when we come right back, because we're approaching the top of the hour. I want to get from you your take, Michael, on why the mainstream media hasn't cornered anybody in the administration with some of these subjects. I mean, last night, for example, there was a major news conference, and not one reporter brought up any of these questions. I want to get your take on why not. We'll be back in a moment. Michael, this show could be part one of a part two. There's just so much to cover, even in a lengthy program such as this, you know.
I have that impact on people.
Okay, yesterday there was a presidential news conference, opportunity for all these reporters to ask some really tough questions. Even during the first campaign, the presidential campaign, other than some books that made some of these allegations and brought out some of these stories, and of course what you've been doing over the years, not one major reporter has really tried to hone in on this, and nothing came up yesterday as well. Nobody talked about what's going on in Afghanistan. Nobody talked about opium fields. Why don't they do that?
Well, there's two reasons. First of all, in a presidential press conference now, it's like those who get close to the emperor are those who are known in advance will not upset the emperor with their questions, even though a couple, you know, were...
They tried.
Kind of testy, yeah, but nobody really went to the hard stuff. I mean, you notice that he had a list in front of him of who he was going to ask questions and in what order. And that has gotten much, much tighter under the Bush administration. One journalist in particular, Helen Thomas, for whom I have a great deal of respect, had really gotten on Bush's case, but you don't see her at press conferences anymore, do you?
No.
Also,
she is 210 years old.
Well,
too,
yeah, only about 208 maybe, but you're right. But she's not there anymore. But at a much deeper level, here we go back to the economic issues with $600 billion a year moving through the U.S. financial system. Every major media outlet in the country is traded on Wall Street. GE owns NBC. Disney owns ABC. Of course, CNN is Time Warner, AOL. Every major outlet, CBS's Viacom, trades their stock on Wall Street. So they are part and parcel beneficiaries of the same corrupt system, which they don't dare to challenge. We have a whole host of incredible reporters, in some cases Emmy Award-winning producers like Christina Borgeson from CBS News, April Oliver from CNN, who did groundbreaking, wonderful stories that threatened the whole system. April Oliver, who did the tailwind stories for CNN, was later...
She got bounced, didn't she?
Yeah, she was fired and trashed publicly, but she won. She was vindicated. There was a whole series of suits afterwards,
right.
And my publication was the first publication anywhere to obtain and publish the deposition in those suits of retired Joint Chiefs Chairman Admiral Thomas Moore, in which he admitted that sarin gas had been used in Laos in 1970. After that, all the suits went away, and I spoke to April. And she said, well, Mike, I am prohibited from telling you the terms of the settlement. However, I can tell you that I just bought a new house, a brand new car, and I paid for 3 years of law school at George Mason with cash. The same thing happened to her co-producer on that story, Jack Smith.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a great book by Christina Borgeson, who was at CNN and worked on TWA 800, called Into the Buzzsaw. It's about what happens to real ethical producers who really try to tell the story fearlessly, and what happens is they get chewed up, spit out, and thrown away, and they become object lessons.
In order to rally around the flag, you need an event. You need something to happen if you need to conclude some kind of an operation, some kind of a plan.
Mm-hmm.
I do not believe, and then we're going to talk about Iraq later on tonight as well. I want to get your take on that. But I do not believe the American people would have supported any kind of military intervention into Afghanistan unless they felt that there was a reason for that. And, of course, chasing Osama bin Laden into Afghanistan was, of course, the reason. The big question, of course, is that the event of 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Right now we have the commission going on, the 9/11 Independent Commission, investigating what is going on. I do not know, quite honestly, Michael, if they will do a thorough enough job. Michael Caine has thrown out some references that the American public will be surprised when we come out with some things. And I don't know if he's dangling a carrot or not. And I'm not sure if they'll really get to the bottom of what's going on in a situation that is extremely frustrating, because I've heard, you've heard, all kinds of stories about this, including did we really know about what was going on? And, mm-hmm. and just yesterday in the presidential news conference, I thought the president stepped over some of his own answers.
He did.
When he was thrown that question several times during the performance.
Well, he made a very serious mistake in that by referring to the Genoa G8 summit, which took place in July of 2001. And again, I have sort of sourced this. I was one of the first to bring it out, but there was an LA Times story supplemented by other stories from Europe, which said very clearly that Italian authorities and Italian intelligence had penetrated Al-Qaeda cells, including by putting microphones in a Citroen used by a couple members of one cell. But they had uncovered a plan to crash hijacked airliners into the Genoa G8 summit to kill George W. Bush. As a result, George W. Bush slept on an aircraft carrier. Genoa was placed under martial law, ringed with anti-aircraft guns, and the airspace was closed off. And this was in the LA Times. So, you know, and his second mistake, which was egregious to me, it was dumb is what it was. I mean, if I was Andy Sipowicz in NYPD Blue and I heard George Bush say that, I'd be throwing him up against the wall and saying, you idiot, don't you know you just confessed? When he parroted a line that had been used by Condi Rice and Ari Fleischer right after 9/11, we had no idea that aircraft could be used as weapons. That is one of the biggest lies I have ever heard told on a public stage anywhere. Not only have I documented a multiplicity, I mean like a 10, 11, 12 warnings from foreign governments about hijacked aircraft being crashed into important buildings and in some cases very specifically into the World Trade Center. Colleen Rowley, the FBI agent in Minneapolis, Time Magazine's Woman of the Year, had it in her notes that the agents were talking about crashing airliners into the World Trade Center. One very interesting thing comes up, which kind of puts it in perspective, and that's that in October of 2000, the Pentagon staged an emergency drill simulating the crash of a hijacked airliner into the Pentagon. Now, how could Bush and Rice and Cheney say that they had no idea that such a thing would happen?
And yet, a lot of people in this country will turn their head and not listen.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of like I said before: denial is not a river in Egypt. This is a big psychological thing for many people to eat. It's like, don't tell me that gravity suddenly means that things fall up instead of down, and don't tell me that. Green means stop and red means go.
Well, why don't they admit then that they were wrong, that they didn't read the signs, that they screwed up, and get on with it? A bigger man admits that he's wrong once in a while.
Yeah, but you see, here to admit that you're wrong admits that it means admitting that you're a criminal. And the U.S. government has criminal, direct involvement in the attacks of 9/11. We needed those attacks. Just a few minutes ago, you were talking about an external threat. And, my God, you sounded almost exactly like Zbigniew Brzezinski, Jimmy Carter's former national security advisor, who wrote in a book called The Grand Chessboard in 1997, 4.5 years before the attacks, about the coming conflict in Central Asia and the Middle East, and that, to use Brzezinski's own words, he said the shock effect of the attack on Pearl Harbor and another place, he says, without a direct external threat, the American people would never support, the imperial mobilization. Those were his words. Necessary to control this vital region. And what's necessary to control there is 60% of the world's oil is in the Middle East.
Are you saying, though, that there are those in government who intentionally turn their head and let 9/11 happen? Or are you saying that there are those in government who helped plot, mastermind what occurred with Osama bin Laden as the stooge and the vehicle for what was going on?
Well, here's what I think. It's more the latter than the former. But here's what I think, is that we have clear evidence that a number of the alleged 9/11 hijackers trained at U.S. military facilities, from the Pensacola Naval Air Station, that's Mohammed Atta, to Maxwell Air Force Base, that was Atta and Maxwell. She, I think, trained at Pensacola. Others had received foreign language training at the Defense Language School in Monterey.
But as Saudis, right, at the time?
No. Some were Saudis, yes, but they were not part of the Saudi military.
Oh, okay.
None of them ever were. So there's a direct military connection, and what I think is that some of Al-Qaeda's cells had been taken over by the CIA and were run somewhat independently of bin Laden. And I think that there is clear evidence that two of the hijackers, for example, Al-Hazmi and Al-Midar, who were on a CIA watch list, they were wanted, they were linked to the Cole bombing, who had attended a major Al-Qaeda terrorism summit in Malaysia in 2000, were allowed to enter the country even though they were on watch list, and the FBI had put out a notice saying, pick these guys up. But what's very strange is, even though they had California driver's license, credit cards, and listed phone numbers, the FBI says they couldn't find them. At the time, they were living with an FBI informant.
Unbelievable. Is there a fight inside our own government between the good and the evil?
Oh, I wish there was.
You don't think so, then?
No. I think there is. People often ask me if I think there's going to be a difference or would be a difference between having George Bush or John Kerry as president. And my response is, we'll have much better theme music with John Kerry. It'll be a fisted glove in velvet. But it's basically no different from having arguing about whether you're going to be ruled by the Genovese or the Gambino crime family. I mean, John Kerry's going to continue the war on terror. He's going to institute a draft. We've written heavily about that. He's going to increase the army by two divisions. He says he's going to fight the war on terror better. And from the wilderness, we've been saying now for 3 years exactly where this war is going to go. And it's been going exactly where we pointed
to. And you think this is all done for economic gain for a few?
No. I think this is being done because the world is beginning to run out of hydrocarbon energy. And those who have hydrocarbon energy survive, and those who don't, don't.
So are they doing this for our own benefit, Michael? For yours? For mine? For our kids?
Not in my name, they're not. They think that they're doing it for my benefit. I will go to my grave firmly convinced that the deepest, darkest secrets of 9/11 lie buried in Vice President Dick Cheney's National Energy Policy Development Group, which is the subject...
Which they will not release.
Well, yeah, there's a coming Supreme Court decision this July, and it's strange that as soon as it was announced that the Supreme Court was going to hear the case, last January, Dick Cheney takes Justice Antonin Scalia on a duck hunting trip paid for by Dick Cheney and the U.S. government on a Secret Service jet. That's a conflict of interest.
Yes, it is.
Scalia has refused to recuse himself. But we do have a glimpse of what's under the door there because two suits have been filed, one by the Sierra Club on the left, the other by Judicial Watch on the right. That's Larry Klayman's group, who challenged the NEPDG on their refusal to release records. This was all funded by taxpayer money.
All right, so on one point here, I want to get a better understanding here. On one point, you're saying all this revolves around the confiscation of oil, basically, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But there are some offshoots to that, and that is continue with the drugs, create cash,
mm-hmm.
Let's go in that direction.
Yes.
So this is a wide scheme if that's indeed occurring.
Well, yeah, because the whole economic system globally is extremely fragile. I mean, you don't have to trust me. You can listen to Alan Greenspan. You can listen to... James Kenneth Galbraith, real economic powerhouses.
Is Greenspan, by the way? Nobody's seen him for a month or so. Somebody said he might have had a heart attack.
I don't know where he is.
All right.
But, the U.S. is awash in debt. I mean, just sinking in debt. Bankruptcies and foreclosures are at all-time highs. It's consumer spending that's keeping this illusory recovery alive. The Chinese economy is growing at 9.1%. Ours at, 1-2%. China has passed Japan as the largest importer, second largest importer of oil in the world. The U.S. economy is terribly fragile with oil prices going through the roof. And in recent lectures, I'm telling people, hey, folks, you're going to look back on the day of $3 a gallon gasoline and go, man, those were the good old days. That's it. That's unavoidable at the present state of world affairs.
That will not happen before this presidential election, I guarantee you.
Not if they can help it. But in looking at oil production numbers, there's a possibility that they might not be able to hold either the economy or oil prices together until then because there is no elasticity anywhere in global oil production. The New York Times recently ran a story That's like 6 months after I ran it, the same story from the wilderness, showing that possibly Saudi Arabia had peaked, and all oil production follows a bell curve. In other words, once you reach the peak, you are forever producing less and less as you slide down the curve.
Now, are you saying, though, now that we're looking at your thoughts of the reasons why all this occurred, are you saying that the CIA and Osama bin Laden planned 9/11?
Again,
somebody had to.
Well, yes, but we have to enlarge, I think, the key players. I think the major banks, Wall Street, the oil companies recognized the necessity to seize oil. And it's a course which was chosen by these fascists. And I use the term fascist. It's a correct term, as Mussolini used it, because he called fascism and corporatism one and the same thing.
All right, but somewhere along the line, Michael, they had to all get, somebody had to get together with somebody and start planning this deed, right?
Mm-hmm.
When did that happen, and how did they do it? And it's been obviously kept quiet.
Well, okay, first of all, we come to a quote from Richard Clark, which has been themed consistently since 9/11 by people who try to dispel this, and it works quite well with people who have no familiarity with covert operations. They say that it's impossible for the U.S. government, would have been impossible, to keep a secret of that size. That's nonsense. The U.S. government kept the Manhattan Project a secret. It kept the stealth fighter a secret. What is key to understanding covert operations is the concept of compartmentalization. People in one room will build a bolt, somebody else will build a framework, somebody else will do the wiring, and nobody looks what the finished gizmo is going to look like. The same thing works in operations of this kind, but it is essential only that maybe a handful of people in extremely key positions get a glimpse of what the real project is. And I will be, and I am naming three of those people who I absolutely sourced and can put them in the same place. Same position, if you will, in my book. One is David Frasca, a supervisory special agent who ran the Radical Fundamentalist Unit at the FBI, who single-handedly stepped on five separate investigations that might have prevented the attacks of 9/11. The second is a man named Ben Sliney, or Sliney, I don't know how he produces his name, who was the FAA hijack coordinator on 9/11, who was the single source point to order, initiate the scrambling of U.S. fighters, which were not scrambled. In time to intercept the hijackings when they had been scrambled routinely 67 times in the calendar year prior to 9/11 for non-emergency.
In rocket ship time, by the way.
Absolutely. Everybody remembers Payne Stewart's plane flying off course, and fighters were flying beside it in a few minutes.
Yes.
Yet we had four simultaneous hijackings, and no fighters scrambled for, in some cases, over an hour. That's inexcusable. Why did not that not happen? And a third figure is Carl Inderforth of State, who was State's, if you will, babysitter for Al-Qaeda throughout the period. So you only need a few people in the right places to know, and maybe only a few at the very top get the whole picture of what's happening.
This could very well be one of the most unbelievable stories one has ever heard, if all of it is true.
I believe it is true. And I think when my book comes out, you'll see that I've proved the case.
Does it bother you?
Oh, well, you know what bothers me? Is that 26 years ago, I tried to tell people that CIA was stealing drugs. And one of the things that I saw, and I wasn't alone, was that if that wasn't addressed then, and I said it the same thing during Iran-Contra, if the route wasn't gotten to then, I said it during BCCI, I said it during Waco, I said it during, you know, so many scandals since. That if you don't get to the root of this problem and solve it, it can only get worse. And that's what bothers me. I mean, one of my dear friends, Celerino Castillo, won a Bronze Star in Vietnam, and he was the DEA's number one guy in Guatemala during the Iran-Contra era. And he was watching the CIA load planes full of cocaine. And he went to the ambassador and said, "We got to make him stop this." And the ambassador said, "Hey, leave it alone. It's a White House operation."
All right. When we come back, let's talk about Iraq. Who's controlling those oil fields right now in terms of who's pumping the oil? What's happening there? I'll be back in a moment with Michael Rupert. Michael, let's jump ahead just for a moment to Iraq, because there's probably some kind of tie-in here with the larger picture. And, of course, it all stems with oil. Regardless of our past relationship with Saddam Hussein, which he was on good terms with us, of course, when we provided him chemical weapons that, again, the mainstream media doesn't seem to push You know, I think one of the reasons why this administration says that he had weapons of mass destruction is because we gave them to him, and probably we didn't know what happened to them or whether he used them all. Be that as it may, we have taken over Iraq. We are fighting in various areas as some of their militants continue to uprise. But the oil fields in the north and the south, are they completely contained now by our troops? I believe they are, aren't they?
Yeah, they are contained by either U.S. or British troops. In Mosul in the north, which is Kurdish, in the central area, but down south in the Basra, they're controlled by the British, which would go back to the old BP franchises from the 1920s. It's very interesting to note that all the oil in the Middle East is in a very small area. You say the Persian Gulf and you think it's a big area, but all the oil fields are in an area that's roughly the size of the state of Indiana, and that's everything from Iran to Iraq to Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Kuwait, Qatar, all of them. And those fields are under control, but they are not producing. The peak of Iraqi production in 1990 was 3.5 million barrels a day. Today it's about 2 million barrels. We will not be able to reach any larger production levels without an investment of, some people estimate, as high as $15 to $20 billion in several years of infrastructure work. Yet pipelines are being blown up so fast. There's one that's taken on a nickname of the flute. But that's a secondary issue, I think, in some respects, because that oil is in effect in the bank.
Who's blowing up those pipelines? The militants?
Yeah.
Okay.
There is one pipeline that has not been sabotaged that's been flowing quite freely, and that runs directly to Haifa in Israel, believe it or not. However, I have some background in the oil industry. Every year I get a check for like $1.97 from my 1/64th share of the Hunt Nutter family gas wells in West Virginia.
You guys are going to be rich.
Oh, right? Hey, listen, I'm a mogul. What's clear in the oil business is that if you've got something in the ground that's selling today at $40 a barrel and you know that in a year it's going to be selling at $60, you don't sell it today.
You don't sell it. That's true.
So that oil's in the bank. It'll be gotten to when is necessary, but this is why, at From the Wilderness, my newsletter, which I encourage people to subscribe to. It's a great investment, you know, cheap really by comparison for the information. We predicted where these conflicts were going to be going. We said that they would go from Afghanistan to Iraq, which is 11% of all the known oil on the planet.
Second largest oil reserves in the world, right?
After Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
Iraq's got about 112 billion barrels, proven reserves. Saudi Arabia, maybe 212 billion barrels, proven reserves, 25% of the oil on the planet. And that, again, is in a very small sliver of land in the eastern part of Saudi Arabia, which can easily be balkanized and partitioned should the Saudi kingdom become unstable,
right,
which it's showing signs of doing. But to West Africa, which has much smaller reserves. But the difference is that it takes 6 weeks to get a drop of oil from the Persian Gulf into an American gas tank and only 2 weeks to get it from, say, Nigeria or Cameroon into an American gas tank. It only takes 4 days to get a drop of oil from Venezuela into an American gas tank. And when there's no elasticity, the access to supply is as critical as the size of reserves.
And eventually we got to talk about Venezuela, because there may be a tie-in here, too, because
yes,
there's some tremendous is very unstable there now, too. What company do we know is pumping out the oil that is pumped in Iraq right now?
Well, there are many companies who have interests, all of which are now under an American protectorate umbrella. There was an executive order issued by the White House, I think, about a year ago, saying that it would make the decisions on behalf of American companies. And that was part of the big hassle with France, Germany, Russia, and many of the European countries,
mm-hmm,
before the invasion, where the U.S. said, look, if you guys don't come with us, we're not going to honor your contracts to pump Iraqi oil after we go there. And that's why France desperately wants in now by one means or another, because French oil supplies through Totalfina Elf are stretched. But right now, Halliburton has the no-bid contract to pump and repair the Iraqi oil fields.
There's some former Vice President Dick Cheney's,
right,
company that he ran.
Right. Bechtel and some other companies will have smaller contracts, but I think Halliburton's the prime on that.
I mean, he didn't own the company. He was a shareholder in a public company.
He was the CEO, chief executive officer, yes.
And is he still one of the major shareholders, or did he give up all those shares, put them in a trust, or what did he do?
I think he put them in a blind trust.
All right.
He might have had a severance package, a huge severance package. I know that he still has income from Halliburton.
And there is some question whether he is getting some kind of a retirement fee or something like that.
Yeah. You could probably say that. And it's also very interesting to note that Halliburton has a subsidiary, which I have a long term. It's ironic that in 1977, when I was in New Orleans and I actually saw the CIA involved in the drug trade, that the company that was involved was called Brown & Root. A longtime CIA contractor, Brown & Root, is today a subsidiary of Halliburton, and they do military logistics stuff. They have the kitchens, they're feeding the troops, they're housing them, they're doing all the ancillary support services.
That's the same company that the Pentagon is accused of kickbacks and some all kinds of things, and they want money back, I guess, right?
I'm shocked, yes. Yes.
Well, now let's assume that on June 30th we relinquish control to Iraq, as the president has continued to say. That's a pretty close date. It's coming up in 2 months. Do you believe we're going to walk away from those oil fields from the north and the south?
Well, number one, assuming that it happens, and I am extremely skeptical that that's going to happen. I just don't see how, on God's grace, I don't know who they're going to hand what over to and how it's going to operate when they do.
It'll be a North Vietnam situation into the South again if we merely walk out right now.
I think it'd look more like a wearing blender set on puree.
I agree with that.
It'd be a madhouse. But turning over the government, in no means said, and President Bush was extremely clear in his press conference, that doesn't mean the military's leaving. We are never going to walk out of Iraq. The U.S. military is there to stay. It's not coming home.
For a long, long time.
Long time.
And again, my question is these oil fields, are we going to ever leave the control of those oil fields? Or will we just give them back to the Iraqi people?
Well, I don't think we'll ever give them back to the Iraqi people, because the Iraqi people might then take the oil and give it to somebody else. And the U.S. can never afford to be without energy supply.
All right. Some would say then that we are protecting our own interests and rah-rah for what we have done.
Well, see, that's something I will never say, because it has to do with how we protect our interest and what methodology we used. I mean, in a recent lecture I gave with my dear friend, the Honorable Cynthia McKinney, former congresswoman from Georgia, who is going to retake her seat in the next election.
Yeah, she wants back in, doesn't she?
She's just announced, and the woman who stole it from her 2 years ago just fled. She said, I'm going to run for the Senate, and gave up her house.
Well, what do you mean stole it from her?
Well, McKinney lost her election in a primary in July of 2002, in which it has been documented, and there's a pending court case, that 43,000 Republicans, in an orchestrated fashion, Cynthia has copies of the Republican material telling Republicans to vote as Democrats, crossed over and voted as Democrats for Cynthia McKinney's opponent, who had been a Republican judge supporter of Alan Keyes.
Oh, I see.
So that suit is pending, and Cynthia...
That's what you mean by stolen.
Yeah, absolutely. At any rate, where were we going with that?
Well, we were talking about the Iraq oil fields, and I said that will we ever walk away from them? And you say no.
No, absolutely not, because the Iraqi people might then give the oil someplace else, and the point is there's no place else to go.
Okay, so we'll take over the oil fields. Do we then move on to... What's project number three? Afghanistan, Iraq, what's next on the table?
What I see next very clearly is two events, and I'm not sure which will happen first. I see the destabilization of the Saudi government to the point where, let's say for the purposes of argument, a President Kerry would deem it, in the event of a revolution or destabilization in Saudi Arabia, which, wink and a nod, the U.S. would have encouraged, in which President Kerry would deem it necessary to send U.S. troops to protect the Saudi oil fields. And, of course, we're already there. Our military bases, literally on a map, have the Saudi oil fields surrounded everywhere but to the west, and there's nothing to the west but desert. Nobody else can get to them.
Well, don't we also have, though, at the time, a very sympathetic Saudi royal family?
Oh, yes and no. There are many factions in the Saudi royal family. Now, King Fahd is literally just a comatose shell of a human being kept alive by life support.
Right.
Last I heard, he was on the island of Malacca off of Spain. He had a stroke in 96, but he's gotten worse, according to my sources. But you have two brothers who are vying for the throne. There's Crown Prince Abdullah and his brother Sultan, who are literally opponents of each other. One is more fundamentalist than the other. That's Abdullah. One controls the military. The other controls the National Guard. But within that, you have an extremely restive Saudi population of many different factions, not just radical fundamentalists, but you have a very angry, upset middle class, so to speak, enraged at the corruption of the royal family. Saudi Arabia has been borrowing money, believe it or not, for some time to support its domestic programs. And if the New York Times story that was published recently and reports by Matthew Simmons, the world's largest investment banker, are correct that Saudi Arabia has peaked, that will spell the end of the Saudi monarchy, because the unrest will be immediate when they can't pay the bills at home anymore.
Right, that's true.
So there's a very interesting dynamic there, because on the other hand, Saudi Arabians, some of them are major players in the U.S. economy. For example, Prince Al-Walid bin Talal is the second largest shareholder in Citigroup.
True. He bailed it out,
that's
as a
right.
matter of fact.
And he's also the second largest stockholder in News Corp after Rupert Murdoch. That's Fox News.
And you know what? He started with just a handful of $100-some million and parlayed it into billions.
Yeah. And that's just one of many heavy Saudi players. So we have seen, I even wrote about it more than a year ago, two streams of capital. One was some Saudis angry at the U.S. pulling their investments out of Wall Street, and the other was Saudis who were getting ready to flee the country, sending flight capital to Wall Street.
Well, at what point then, Michael, does some of these other countries that are watching us continue then to take over oil fields and things like that, when do they start saying enough is enough?
Oh, that's already in progress. Let me just backtrack for 1 second, if I may, George, because there were two things that I see imminent. The other, which I'm absolutely certain of, is increased military guerrilla conflict throughout West Africa. We will see direct links to the in the Spanish bombing to Morocco, and in sub-Saharan Africa, just south of there, Kerr McGee and other companies have just taken major oil leases. The U.S. Navy gave 6 warships to Nigeria. NATO announced last fall that it was shifting its focus to West Africa. You know, I've been tracking this very carefully, so we will see a lot of insurgency throughout West Africa.
All you got to do is look at the OPEC producing nation list.
Look, see where the reserves are. And, of course, recently we had the U.S.-sponsored coup d'etat in Haiti, and Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, is no fool. The U.S. has tried to overthrow him twice by U.S.-sponsored intelligence-backed coups. Very funny. One of my favorite quotes was, I think it was John Negroponte went to the OAS, the Organization of American States, and said, well, President Chavez needs to have a referendum. And Chavez said, I just won an election 6 months ago. As a matter of fact, I've won 4 elections. How many has your man won?
Well, let me tell you, though, Michael, assuming what you say is true, all this stuff, I still believe that what's very important to a lot of people at home, because they're not close to all this, of course, albeit those people who have had their young men and women die over there in Afghanistan and Iraq, they're close to this.
Right.
My hearts go out to them. But most people aren't really close to what's going on out there. All they really see is the pump price at the gasoline,
right,
and things like that. So as long as their standard of living is comfortable, how many people in this country, and you talked a little bit about this 1 in 100 poll, but how many in this country really would step in and say, enough is enough?
I think that number is growing rapidly as it becomes more transparent, what is being done, why, and how. Dick Cheney said that, quote, the American way of life is not negotiable. I used a quote in some of my lectures from a great movie, 3 Days of the Condor, by Sidney Pollack. 1975 movie, at the end of the movie is Cliff Robertson saying, yeah, it was about seizing Middle East oil fields, and when American people start going hungry and they can't drive their cars, they're going to want us to go out and get the oil. They won't ask us anything else. Maybe that's true. I'm hoping that there's something better in the American spirit than that, because that's certainly not the way I want to conduct foreign policy.
It doesn't sound like we're doing anything then to get away from our reliance on oil.
Well, that's the other side of this coin, and I have a wonderful energy science editor, Dale Allen Pfeiffer, who has, he's a geologist among other trades, who has written just so many wonderful articles as well as the ones that, I've written, but we have thoroughly evaluated alternative energy sources, and we have two major problems. One is that there is no combination of alternative energy sources that will allow the United States or the world to continue its current consumption levels with a growing population of 6.5 billion people that will be 9 billion people by the middle of the century. The second problem is it takes about 30 years to make infrastructure changes. In other words, to build the factories, the pipelines, whatever it is that you're going to replace the old system with. And we are 30 years behind that curve because peak oil is here now. So, you know, the only way out that I see is what's called contraction and convergence. But here again, we come back to the money problem.
Well, you're also assuming that they're going to allow 9 billion people on this planet. You know, we've always heard the word that they would love to have this world population reduced dramatically.
Well, I've written extensively about that, too, and, of course, in all the biological warfare subtext that have presented themselves since 9/11, I certainly see, and we've actually done a lot of research on the possible and likely development of gene-specific bioweapons.
Coming up on the top of the hour, much more to talk with you about, Michael. We'll also open up the phone lines, give everybody a chance to try to squeeze in here as well. Quick question, is it possible, because you've made some allegations here, is it possible that our president had no idea what was happening with 9/11 and was probably taken advantage of?
No. Vladimir Putin said clearly on MSNBC days after the attacks that he ordered President Bush warned in the strongest possible terms, and a supporting story in Izvestia on September 12, 2001, just a day later after the attacks, said that Putin had dispatched personal emissaries to CIA headquarters with the names of the hijackers, saying they were going to crash planes into the World Trade Center. There's no way Bush can say he didn't know that.
Well, who would you believe, though, Putin or Bush?
Well, since Putin is supported also by stories from Germany, France, Jordan, Israel, Turkey, a whole bunch of other countries saying exactly the same thing, I think I believe Putin.
We'll be back in a moment. Michael Rupert, my guest. I told you, he's controversial. Don't go away. Michael, I had heard shortly after 9/11 there were a few broadcast stories, then it seemed to fade away, that there were major short sellings of various stocks and options after 9/11. Had you checked into that?
Oh, yeah. We broke some of the first stories on the insider trading, which was massive right before 9/11. There was worldwide placement of put options, which are basically bets that a stock price is going to fall when you don't have to own the price when you buy the option. But when you sell the stock, you can go out and buy it for 25, but your option allows you to sell it for 100.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just making up the numbers there.
I understand.
The insider trading occurred on financial markets in Tokyo, Chicago, Hong Kong, New York, London, and Berlin. Andreas von Bülow, a good friend of mine who I'll be visiting in Germany May, is the former German cabinet minister who was in charge of Germany's intelligence services, and he estimated the level of trading at possibly as much as $100 billion. Now, that goes back, from my understanding, to the very, very close, long-established relationships between intelligence services and the financial market.
$100 billion?
Possibly. Again, he was estimating. Trades were also confirmed by Ernst Weltecke, then the president of the German State Bank. Maybe $10 billion. CBS News, Bloomberg, Broadband Research, major financial wire services reported on this insider trading, which occurred only on United and American Airlines, no other airlines, in the week prior to the attacks. It occurred on the stocks of Merrill Lynch and Morgan Stanley, both of which were devastated by the attacks, and major reinsurance companies, which are companies that insure other insurance companies,
mm-hmm.
that were devastated.
Okay.
Many of the UAL put options were placed in New York through a unit of Deutsche Bank called the Alex Brown Unit, or A.B. Brown. That was headed until 1998 by a man named Buzzy Krongard, who is today the number three man at CIA.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Now, the SEC goes zooming down on Martha Stewart and nails her for about a $50,000 deal. I believe that's how much it was for her. We're talking about $100 billion. My point here, it's easy for them to track who's doing what.
Oh, there's no question.
So there have been no indictments. There have been no arrests. There has not been, as far as I'm concerned, one public acknowledgement of who these individuals or corporations were or funds that invested in these short sales or put options.
There was huge outrage immediately after the attacks. And the SEC even announced, yeah, we can find out who made the trades. Now, you and I can't because it's protected by banking secrecy laws. But the investigations just went away. Now, I had written a story in October of 2000 after being visited by members of the RCMP's national security staff from Canada on a software called Promise, P-R-O-M-I-S, in which we proved conclusively, and it's documented, that major intelligence services use software like Promise to track all stock trades in real time. So there is no question that people were watching these trades, that people knew about it. And my analysis is very simply that all of these nations who had warned the U.S. of the attacks, Russia, France, Germany, Jordan, Morocco,
Israel, they were part of it.
Israel.
They warned us.
It was known that these attacks were going to be allowed to happen, and that information migrated quite naturally from the intelligence services to the financial markets, which caused the trades.
I think, in addition to all the things we've talked about tonight, this is probably one of the hottest potatoes around, because if they could track and reveal to us who profited off this, there are your co-conspirators.
Well, yes and no. I mean, as I analyze the warnings from foreign intelligence services, which are very well documented in the press, and I footnote everything that I do academically. You'll see it in my book that, you know, I source everything. I ask no one to accept anything. But I see a lot of these intelligence services made direct warnings, like the German BND, to directly to CIA using echelon technology to wiretap, to eavesdrop on conversations, that many of these intelligence services were going, I don't understand what the Americans are doing. You know, they...
Or the lack of.
Yes, they were nonplussed. They go, well, holy moly, they're going to let this stuff happen. Some may have been participants. I really do think that Israel, the Israeli intelligence service Mossad, played a role in facilitating the attacks in partnership with the U.S. government. I am not someone who says that Israel did the attacks. There's a big distinction there that I really have to make clear. But I have read, and I have in my possession, a DEA report from 2001 showing that a ring of Israeli art students, some 140 of them, had come into the U.S., and they were actually tracking Mohammed Atta, al-Shihi, al-Hazmi, and al-Midar, and living in some cases just blocks from them before the attack.
Now, are you convinced that those players were on the planes when the planes hit?
No, I'm not. You know, that's just one of those I don't know questions. We do have bona fide solid reports from like ABC News and the BBC that as many as five, possibly even seven, of the so-called 19 hijackers are still alive and well. Here we are...
Or the names of.
Yeah, no, in some cases I think they were quite sure that it was the same people. But here we encounter a legend, which is a term used in the intelligence trade, of enormous proportions with so many layers of complexity, it's very, very difficult to penetrate. And I've made a tactical decision as a journalist that it's kind of like my own suicide mission, and I won't jump to conclusions about things that I can't prove, and I don't have to prove whether all 19 were aboard the planes or not, to know that the U.S. government facilitated and was a partner in seeing that those attacks took place.
Who do you think was aboard the planes?
I don't know. Stand-ins could be. Again,
I mean, obviously, whoever was on the plane knew that they're going to die, mm-hmm. give up their lives, right?
Well, sure, and this is where I think that you had cells in Al-Qaeda that might have actually been taken over by the CIA through people it had flipped, as they say in the trade.
And they took those people with the mentality of blowing yourself up and got them in there?
Exactly. That's a very plausible explanation for me at the moment.
Let's,
Right. Although, I can't say for sure.
Let's go to the phones. You ready, Michael? Because they are lining up. We'll pick it up, first of all, by going east of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast, you're on with Michael Rupert on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Good.
I really enjoy listening to your guest. I agree with a lot of what you have to say, Mr. Rupert, but the peak oil stuff, I have a problem with this because there's something called the price mechanism, and, of course, consumption runs inversely with prices. And the unhampered market is certainly more than capable of accounting for things like capital depreciation as well as demand versus supply in order to determine what the market clearing price should be. And so it's government interference with the market through spending, subsidies, taxes, land acquisition, and so forth that is injurious to this accounting process. And so if peak oil is a problem, then it's only in as much as the government's making it a problem, and I'm seeing some of the peak oil stuff as actually providing an impetus for more government control, and that certainly concerns me.
Well, first of all, in a standard Keynesian or Adam Smithian model, you might be right. But oil is definitely a finite supply, and the fact is that the world is incredibly dependent upon hydrocarbon energy. The world economy is, since it's based on fractional reserve banking, debt-based financing, fiat currency, is literally a pyramid scheme of sorts, which if it doesn't grow, it dies. And over the last, I think it's 50 years, there has been like a 96% correlation between economic growth or GDP growth and greenhouse gas emission, which is a direct result of energy consumption. The world eats 10 calories of hydrocarbon energy for every calorie of food. And that is a problem of enormous proportions. All fertilizers are made out of natural gas. All food crops, you drive an oil-powered vehicle to plant them, you burn oil or natural gas to run electric pumps to irrigate them, you harvest them with oil-powered vehicles, you wrap them in plastic, which is oil, you spray them with pesticides, which are made from oil. And these are like non-negotiable entities which market forces cannot control. You cannot say that a market will force people to consume less than a minimum daily requirement of calories. You cannot say that market forces will force people who live in Los Angeles here to stop living in Lancaster and Palmdale driving 80 miles one way to work. Those things don't negotiate well.
CIA Director George Tenet told the 9/11 Commission that the CIA is not equipped to deal with terrorist surveillance. So now I'm really confused.
I have a whole list in one chapter in my book of documented penetrations of Al-Qaeda, which are just astonishing, including there was a terrorism trial in Southern District of New York under a great prosecutor, Mary Jo White, and UPI correspondent Richard Sale wrote about it, where it was released in the trial. This was, I think, 5 months before, or 6 months before the 9/11 attacks, that the National Security Agency had broken Osama bin Laden's secure communications. That's just one. If anybody in Al-Qaeda burped, we knew it, and that is a complete lie on Tenet's part.
So one of the things they wanted us to think then was that our intelligence services were just complete buffoons.
Yeah, I have had this story pulled up, hoping that at some point in this conversation tonight I would get a chance to say this. And this is a quote from the RAND Corporation study. RAND Corporation works with CIA and the U.S. Air Force, major think tank. And just two short paragraphs from a 2001 study on terrorism. It says, in actual operations and special events, agencies generally coordinated their activities. For example, we examined several overseas counterterrorist operations and found that the agencies generally followed the draft interagency international guidelines. DOD, the FBI, and the CIA performed their respective roles in military planning, law enforcement, and intelligence gathering under the oversight of state. Minor interagency tensions or conflicts were resolved and did not appear to have posed a risk to the mission. In a similar vein, FBI data on terrorism in the U.S. suggests a reasonably high degree of success in terrorism prevention activities at home. Only a small annual number of actual terrorist incidents occurred in recent years, and more preventions of terrorist incidents than actual incidents themselves. And it documents before that something like 45 attempts by Al-Qaeda had been thwarted. Now, that's a RAND Corporation study, which means that this myth that is being spun for us in the media of intelligence failures is a bold-faced lie. It's a cover story.
Unbelievable. Wild card line, your turn. You're on with Michael Rupert. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Tim from L.A.
Hi, Tim.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you.
Great. Mike, I got a question I'd like to ask. I visited your website, and I did a run, a check, on your search engine.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, the Christic Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And I came up with that's a really interesting story. Where did they go wrong in their lawsuit? And the way you're presenting your story and everything, do you think you would fall, I guess, the same demise as the Christic did? Because I know you're getting a lot of facts, a lot of the stuff that I heard, because I used to volunteer with the Christic. And I'm kind of nervous. And, well, I'd like to hear the answer. I'll hang up and hear the answer on the air.
Okay. Well, I had dealings with the Christic Institute back during the Iran-Contra years, and I also had contact with John Kerry's office at the time, who was running the Iran-Contra hearings. What happened in the Christic Institute case, and I have the most recent story on that I think is beyond Bush 2, and you can do a search for Daniel Sheehan.
And explain the Institute.
On my website. It was a Catholic-based institute which filed a RICO, racketeering influenced and corrupt organizations lawsuit against what they called the shadow government, which included many of the Iran-Contra players, Ted Shackley, Richard Secord, John Singlaub, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, charging them with, among other things, massive drug smuggling. The RICO suit, now, Christic went around the country and raised, I think, tens of millions of dollars, or certainly in the millions of dollars of money to prosecute this lawsuit, but the suit was sabotaged. The suit was ruined by legal misconduct by the lead attorney, Daniel Sheehan, who submitted an affidavit in which he listed witnesses who were either dead or non-existent, and this is a ruling, I'm quoting here from the court record itself, so I'm not making this up. So I don't operate the way Christic operates. I run a privately owned, non-publicly traded, sole proprietorship newsletter. I pay my writers. I'm not soliciting donations for a lawsuit. I have followed court cases now for some 25 years, been involved in a couple of my own, and I have no faith in the legal system. So I'm not trying to solve anything here by a lawsuit, nor am I trying to sell people a magic bullet solution where I say, if you do what I tell you to, everything is going to be fine. I don't do that.
FBI was apparently behind, or somebody was behind, Project Bojinka. What was that? Do you know?
In 1995, Ramzi Youssef was arrested. He was the first World Trade Center bomber. He's closely tied to bin Laden. In the Philippine Islands, where he had been working, I think, with Abu Sayyaf, a Philippine Islamic group with ties to Al-Qaeda, a laptop computer was seized, and on the laptop computer were files relating to Project Bojinka, which called for a massive simultaneous hijacking of commercial airliners, in some cases crashing them into the sea. But what they haven't quite mentioned in the news lately, there was also the prospect of crashing one into CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia.
And nobody noticed.
Well,
if they did notice, they didn't say anything about it.
There are so many instances where the U.S. government was prepared. As a matter of fact, on the day of 9/11 itself, the National Reconnaissance Office, just outside of D.C. in Virginia, was conducting a drill for a hijacked airliner being crashed into their headquarters. How can they, I'm telling you, it's so obvious that Condi Rice, George Bush, and they're all are lying. It's pathetic.
Is it true that some members of government were told not to fly planes that day and not to be in the World Trade Center?
That I cannot prove. And again, I don't speculate. We do know, and I was totally unsatisfied with John Ashcroft's explanation. I mean, CBS News flatly reported that he had stopped flying commercial airliners, flying only on private jets, meaning, I think, DOJ jets, in the months before as a result of a threat assessment.
Did he ever fly in commercial airliners as the Attorney General?
Yes, he did, and he even testified when he testified. I think it was yesterday. He said, "My wife and I flew commercial on September the 3rd." But he said this threat assessment was a vague thing about people who carried weapons moving with me. But then later on in his testimony, he said that a number of other actions had been taken to protect installations and personnel because of the same threat assessment. He contradicted himself. There are other stories that Willie Brown, mayor of San Francisco, received warnings, not from Condoleezza Rice. Those stories have not been proven anywhere. That's a kind of a wives' tale that got out of control. But clearly, some members of the Joint Chiefs did cancel flight arrangements 1 or 2 days before the attacks.
Well, this whole situation, Michael, is, I mean, it's like trying to grab a tiger by the tail, isn't it?
Yeah. But, you know, if we don't grab it, it's going to eat us anyway.
When was this all concocted? Must have been years ago.
Well, I think when you deal with something like this in the world of covert operations, you have little pieces or components of plans laying around on a shelf dormant for some time. It's how you assemble the various components and execute them. I couldn't possibly tell you when somebody first concocted the whole plan. We do know that there was a guy named Delbert Mike Vreeland, who I took a lot of heat over, who claimed he was a lieutenant with the Office of Naval Intelligence, who was incarcerated in Canada in December of 2000. And a month before the attacks, after having been incarcerated, you know, since December, wrote a detailed warning note that said, you know, that was clearly referring to the attacks of 9/11, and we have proven that that letter was sealed into evidence in a Canadian jail a month before the attacks. His lawyers were absolutely clear when they read the note, and having talked to him, it's in their case file, that he was talking about 9/11. So somebody knew that these attacks were being planned.
We'll be back with you, Michael Rupert, and the rest of the phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Michael, sometimes I feel like I'm Howard Beale from the television movie network, and you almost scream out the window that we're just not going to take this anymore.
Amen.
You know, strange comments by what might be Osama bin Laden as he asks for a truce with Europe, but not with us, of course. But an interesting phrase here is that, of course, he's denouncing the U.S. war in Iraq, saying that it's making billions of dollars for companies, whether those that make weapons or those that take part in reconstruction, and he names Halliburton as one of those.
Mm-hmm.
I found that to be very interesting. I guess he reads papers, listens to things, too.
Well, he knows that the battle lines are being drawn, to quote Stephen Stills from Buffalo Springfield. I love your music, by the way. And that is the way some of this warfare is being fought. Right after the coup in Haiti, where we ousted Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Hugo Chavez says, Venezuela is not Haiti and Chavez is not Aristide. And he said, the moment the U.S. tries another coup in Venezuela, I will shut off all U.S. oil. And I clipped a story from a Venezuelan paper showing that a week later, the Chinese government was in Venezuela negotiating to buy all of Venezuela's oil.
Well, I tell you, I don't think this is over yet. And the chapters are yet to be written on whatever could be the end of these books here, the books of what's going on out there. It's just... almost every day, something new unfolds.
Indeed it does, and we're in a period of really intense uncertainty right now.
I think so, too. Well, let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yes, good evening, George and Mike. Michael, I've been a fan of your FTW site for a couple of years now and have had a great education. Thank you for that effort. My question is regarding the, and I know I'm going to mispronounce this, Mike, is the Zim American Israeli Shipping Company. Does that ring a bell for you?
Michael, are you there?
Michael?
Hello? Hello?
Hello, Michael.
Hi.
Are you there?
Yes.
Okay, I'm hearing something in the background on your phone. Maybe
I'm sorry.
That's my guess. Did you hear the guest question?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
Can I repeat?
Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, Michael, I'm a great fan of yours, but I wonder if a particular name of a company, which I know I'm going to mispronounce, rings a bell for you. Zim, American Israeli Shipping Company, and a company owned by Israeli government and independents. Can you comment on that? And its connection to its early move out from the World Trade Center prior to 9/11. I'll hear your answer off the line. Thanks.
Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, that's kind of bad news. I got cut off there, so I missed most of that. I just got back on the line. I did hear a reference to a company that had moved out of the World Trade Center, which would be a reference to the Zim Israeli American Shipping Company, which we documented had moved out of the World Trade Center, and according to sources who spoke to me, said it broke its lease to do so. I didn't hear the other part of the question, though.
Oh, yeah. He primarily wanted to know if they were behind anything.
They who?
That corporation.
Oh, the Zim companies, and there's a Zim Israeli American, there's a Zim Antwerp. Those are all state-subsidized corporations running out of Israel, so they would have direct connections to Israeli intelligence, who I'm sure would have warned them of the attacks. There were other connections with Israeli companies. Now, Israel did, we know, try to warn the U.S. government on some levels about 9/11. On other levels, I think that Israel was complicit and a partner with the U.S. in making sure the attacks happened. But there were two companies, Comverse and Amdocs, who deal with all telephone billing records in the country. Comverse does very secret, sensitive wiretapping operations for the federal government. Both are Israeli-owned. And the Israeli instant messaging service, Odigo, two employees received warnings of the attacks just hours before they occurred. So, you know, the question is, how do you describe the role? And I have a whole chapter in the book devoted to Israel, and I kind of describe America as Frankenstein and Israel as the bride of Frankenstein in a very dysfunctional relationship with each other. Frankenstein will send his wife out to do something he doesn't want to get caught doing. They both behave in poor ways sometimes, but if that metaphor is correct, you have to look for the creator of both monsters, which to me is the world's financial and monetary system.
Mm. Okay, West of the Rockies, your turn. You're on with Michael Rupert. Hi there.
Hi. My name is Gary. I'm from Los Angeles.
Hi, Gary. Go ahead.
I'd like to make a couple of statements, and then I do have a question for Michael. Most of the patriotic organizations in the United States have known about what Michael's been saying for the last couple hours, since almost, you know, right after it happened. The government had been trying for about 20 years to get this Patriot Act passed. They tried it after Waco. They tried it after the Oklahoma situation. They tried it after 93, and only six people were killed there. And as soon as they got 3,000 people killed, then they got it passed. That's one major problem, besides all the other situations you've been talking about this evening. But the question I had for Michael is there anyone on this 9/11 commission that this information could be given to that would do anything about it, or is this just a facade?
Anybody who puts any faith in any part of that commission needs to change their medication, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Every member of that commission has a financial conflict of interest, or a personal conflict of interest with somebody who's responsible. The chairman, Tom Keene, has affiliations with an oil company, one of whose major shareholders is Khalid bin Mahfouz of Saudi Arabia. Everybody there has got problems. That commission was never intended to be anything more than a dog and pony show. That's it.
That's what I figured.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
All right, appreciate your call. Boy, they're lining up. The clock is ticking. Let's go east of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yeah, this is Lewis from Watson, Louisiana. I had a question for you, Gil.
Sure thing. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Okay, I know in 1969 they had a resolution that was passed in Congress for the election. If we're in a major world war, that they couldn't have an election because the troops would still be, you know, overseas fighting the war, and the sitting president would have to stay in until the troops came back. I was wondering if it was still, still around, if it was still on the books, because me and a friend of mine had talked about that tonight, and I was just wondering, you know, what the situation was for it.
I don't know about that particular resolution, but what I found extremely frightening this year was that Bill Safire of the New York Times, one of the biggest columnists in the world, and a major columnist at the Washington Post, whose name escapes me, in separate stories, both suggested the possibility that the 2004 presidential election might be suspended as a result of a terrorist act. So whether they go about it one way or the other, that's a possibility, which to me would seem only plausible in the event that the economy goes completely down the dumper before November.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, appreciate your call. Let's go to our first-time caller line. You are on Coast to Coast with Michael Rupert. Hi there. Hello?
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay, real quick, like, I was wondering what the Justice Department has said with all this evidence this gentleman has and the U.S. Attorney's Office for filing complicity and charges of murder against the president. What did that department say when you filed all this information with their office?
Well, I didn't file the information with their office. I published news stories. They read my website. I know they read my website. The only way the criminal charges could be brought against the president under the Constitution would be articles of impeachment, and that is an absolute impossibility since the Republicans control both the House and the Senate.
What about Bob Kerry on the 9/11 Commission? I've got his phone number. I'm sure he'd be more than interested with the information. I'm sure he could find a way.
Bob Kerry's as corrupt as the rest of them. He's part of the cover-up.
Oh, I saw everyone is part of the cover-up. I bet you're a Democrat, right?
No, as a matter of fact, some of the first major stories I wrote were documenting drug money going directly into Al Gore's campaign. Not everybody is corrupt. Some are cowards and some are stupid. The one member of Congress who I found had unmitigated and unchallenged and untempered courage was Cynthia McKinney.
So there is no one in the government that would do anything about this. Everyone is corrupt, and everyone is doing this all for oil. This is correct?
Well, no. You're vastly oversimplifying it. Many people are just keeping quiet to take care of their own rice bowls. There was one member of Congress who I really had hopes might have done something. His name was Paul Wellstone.
Uh-huh. So other than this Wellstone, so...
Wellstone's dead now.
That's correct.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
Died in a plane crash.
Okay, well, gee, I'm going to I'm going to make some calls tomorrow to see because this is really alarming. The fact is, of what you're saying is true because
in most of everything that Michael has said tonight, whether you agree with it or not, or anybody agrees with it, most of what he has said tonight he has extracted from news reports. Is that not correct, Michael?
News reports or official government documents and public records, and I source everything that I publish so that anyone can go check it for themselves.
All right. Let's go west of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Michael. This is Kathy from Las Vegas, Nevada.
Hi, Kathy.
I just find it really strange how you're talking about this, and... I don't know if you've watched too many movies, but there's a couple of movies that came out in 1996. One was called Executive Decision about an Arab who's going to crash a plane into a building, and one was called The Long Kiss Goodnight.
I didn't see Executive Decision.
Well, Long Kiss Goodnight was Gina Davis. Samuel,
that was a good movie.
Great. The CIA supposedly was behind it. They were going to use a chemical bomb and supposedly... they couldn't figure out a way to fake killing 4,000 people, so they were going to actually kill 4,000 people. And don't you find it strange that so many movies
turn out to be real events?
Turn out to be real events.
Well, I'm a great follower of the psychiatrist Carl Jung, and there is a thing called the collective consciousness, and these things kind of percolate. I mean. We also have the North Woods documents, which are now declassified, formerly top secret documents from 1962 in the Joint Chiefs, which call for shooting down American airplanes, attacking facilities, and blaming it on Fidel Castro. So this stuff percolates, and it does kind of resonate around a little bit. I am hoping that we can find our 100th monkey, that's a long story, to finally make this penetrate into everybody's consciousness.
Do you believe that most of our problems here are stemming from the actions and policies probably dictated by these profiteers, these corporations, these groups that continue to make money on the woes of others?
I think by and large, let me turn it around and just say that until you change the way money works, you will not solve any of these problems.
Well, here's an example, and I used to think about this even in my college days, Michael. I mean, you've got companies that manufacture tanks. Now, the only way for those tanks to get sold is if they get used. And if they get used either in this country or from other countries that are at war, but they are made for wars. So there's a two-edged sword here. One is create a massive defense so you are protected. On the other hand, they want to make money. They want to sell more tanks. You can't sell more tanks unless they're being used.
Yeah.
It's a catch-22. And so one of the things they probably say is, for business purposes, war is great for these companies.
Among other things, yes. Catherine Austin Fitz, again, my dear friend, has a wonderful thing she calls the Popsicle Index, which is on a scale of 0 to 100, what are the chances you can send a five-year-old to the closest store and have the child return home safely with a popsicle? And she points out that in the 1950s, when she was growing up, the Popsicle Index was 95 and the Dow Jones was 800.
Yeah.
Now the Dow Jones is 10,000 and the Popsicle Index is way down, you know.
Yep, absolutely.
Low.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with Michael Rupert. Hi there.
Hi, this is AJ calling from somewhere out there, Canyon Lake, California.
AJ.
Listening on XM, which I got. Because I'm in the KFI delay zone.
Well, maybe that won't last forever.
Well, that would be fantastic. But anyways, you know, a couple days after the attack, I had this absolutely crazy friend telling me basically what your guest is telling us tonight. And I thought he was just off the wall. But I started digging, looking into it, and finding out that a lot of this stuff is true. And what I'm hearing tonight is really cementing it for me. I'm glad to say that you've got the courage to put this out to your 9 million plus listeners. And I find it interesting that the history is that we form some kind of attack so that we can go to war.
That's not news. I mean, that's been very well documented for a long time. And we have George Stinnett's book that came out, I think, 2 years ago, or maybe 3 years ago now, showing that we had broken the Japanese codes and Franklin Roosevelt allowed the Japanese to attack Pearl Harbor. The infamous Gulf of Tonkin attack by North Vietnamese torpedo boats was an absolute fictitious crock of bull, and those things didn't happen. And in some cases, I mean, we have documented cases of the CIA under Ed Lansdale in the 50s dressing up CIA operatives as communists in the Philippines and going through and massacring villages to blame it on the communists. So this is as old as war itself.
Michael, are you saying that if we kind of, as a nation without these corporations that are fueling, I think, some of the fires here, if not all of them, if none of that was occurring, do you think this would be a more peaceful planet?
Definitely. That's one of the things we must do, is that we must incentivize.
But you still will have the crazed Saddam Husseins who kill people.
Yes and no, but Saddam Hussein could not have had the capacity to kill people unless someone had sold him all of his tanks, airplanes, poison gas, and everything else. And that was the United States, France, Britain, and everybody else.
Well, and that's what I'm going to say, though. Eventually, if somebody doesn't make it, he'll find it from someone else, right?
Not necessarily. Not if you remove the financial incentive for making weapons.
It's a tough call, Michael Rupert. All I can say is we're not at the end of this, and I have a feeling we're right in the middle of it all, aren't we?
Yeah, I think that I am absolutely convinced that it's going to be real squirrely between now and the election, but I think that 2005, unfortunately, from any standpoint, economics, energy,
regardless of who the president might be.
Yeah, I think that 2005 is going to be an extremely painful year for the U.S., and I think we'll have a draft back soon, which is going to change the political landscape dramatically.
Well, eventually, the American public will say enough is enough. The problem is, with all this doubt, you'll never know if anything does happen on this soil here. You might not know who's behind it, will you?
Well, I don't know, but one of the things that always gives me hope is I see blades of grass growing up through concrete, and I can't figure out how that happened. So, you know, I think there's hope for us somewhere.
Well said, Michael. Well said. Let's just continue to keep our head above water and make sure that nobody chops it off, huh?
Absolutely.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you so much, George.
For Kiris Coburn, Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Barbara Simpson, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.